This is Take Care, a health and wellness show produced by WRVO. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper. This week we're covering a major public health issue, suicide. We'll also take a look at mental health issues and how they play into our understanding of this difficult topic.
We'll discuss the latest CDC study showing an across-the-board rise in the rate of suicide.
In over half of the states in the United States, the suicide rate had increased by more than 30%.
And with the latest celebrity suicide still on the forefront of the public's mind, experts help us pick apart the relationship between mental health and suicide, as well as the latest efforts in prevention.
Our approach allows us to go to settings like the court system, for example, or primary care for older people, different places like the schools for young adults.
These conversations, plus we'll hear about one company's attempts at objective measurement of mental health. That's on Take Care right after the news.
This is Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith. We're covering a difficult topic this time on Take Care, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be discussed. A number of celebrity suicides earlier this year brought the topic to the forefront, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse.
We're going to take this hour to discuss suicide, as well as mental health. By no means are we implying that mental health problems lead to suicide or that those who commit suicide always have mental health problems, but the two public health issues need addressing, and we've found some excellent guests to help us dispel myths, understand the latest research, and begin to comprehend what needs to be done to stop the current rate of suicide from rising any higher.
The latest study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that the rates of suicide have increased in nearly every state in the U.S. between 1999 and 2016. The study received a lot of attention, with many people asking why.
Joining us to discuss the findings is one of the authors of the CDC study. Dr. Alex Crosby is Surveillance Branch Chief in the Division of Violence Prevention. Dr. Crosby, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
You're one of the authors of the recent CDC study that received a lot of attention, and it concluded that suicide rates increased in nearly every state in the U.S. between 1999 and 2016. Were you surprised by those findings, or was that a trend that you saw coming?
One of the things that motivated us to do this study was that in monitoring the national rates of suicide, that we had observed that the suicide rates across the country were going up. Part of the reason we did that study was to see how it might have been very different in different states, what was happening in regards to the rates. So while we suspected that some states had been going up, we didn't realize, you know, what the magnitude was going to be, and so we wanted to try to measure that.
And how significant was the increase?
It was pretty high. In over half of the states in the United States, the suicide rate had increased by more than 30%. When we looked at state-by-state rates, that pretty much you could identify 44 states in which the suicide rates had gone up what we call statistically significant. So when we measure that, that's our ability to say that this is a real increase.
And did you find any sort of parallels between, like, economic issues or healthcare issues in the many places that the rate did go up?
When we looked at two different aspects of how we could measure what was happening in regards to the rates, one was looking at death certificate information. And death certificate information, while it's very good for measuring the causes of death, and that was the one in which we were able to identify what was happening, you know, state by state, it doesn't tell us very much about what are some of the underlying factors or some of the things that might have precipitated the suicide. And so we used a second data source, the National Violent Death Reporting System, in which we tried to look at some of the circumstances associated with suicides in 27 of the states. The reason that one didn't cover all the states is that that system has been gradually increasing the number of states. And at the time that we did the study, using the data from 2015, there were only 27 states in that particular data system. We couldn't answer specifically exactly what was behind the increases. What we could do is, based on other research, identify some of the factors that have been connected to suicides in the past. Some research has shown that the economy can play a role in increasing suicides, that when the economy is in a decline, suicide rates tend to go up. When the economy is getting better, suicide rates tend to go down. We also note that substance abuse, especially opioid-related substance abuse, has been going up in the United States. Well, substance abuse is a risk factor for suicidal behavior, so that could have also contributed to what was going on. So there are several different factors that, at the same time that the suicide rates were going up, those factors may have been changing. And suicide is a complex human phenomenon in which there's no really one thing that puts a person at risk or causes a person to engage in suicidal behavior. So it was probably a combination of different factors that played a role.
I don't know how long suicide rates have been measured, but if you could put this in perspective, have we ever seen such a significant rise before, or is this really new territory?
This is new territory for us to be able to identify what was going on in a state-by-state fashion. When we look historically at suicide rates in the United States, we are able to go back to 1933. That was the first year for which we had all of the, you know, at that point, 48 states in the vital statistics system. And actually, we did see very high rates of suicide back during the Great Depression. And there have been some studies that have tried to look at some of the national trends in suicide over time, but not many, and we believe that this was one of the first, to really look at what was happening in a state-by-state fashion.
You mentioned that there's no one reason that leads to suicide, but, you know, many of us think about mental health issues, depression, and those kinds of things leading to suicide. Is there a clear relationship between an increase in mental health issues and suicide?
We don't know about an increase, but that is definitely a major risk factor for suicidal behavior, is the issue of mental illness. When we looked at our second data source, and that was that National Violent Death Reporting System, one of the things we found when we looked at that system, because it did report on what were some of the precipitating events for suicide, that actually some of the leading identified risk factors had to do with relationship problems or job problems, financial problems. And mental illness was identified in less than half of those that had died as a result of suicide. Now, that's when we talk about, was it identified? So there may have been others that may have been at risk, but at least in regards to those for whom it was identified, relationship problems were the biggest risk factor. I think that, again, kind of points back to the issue that suicide oftentimes results from multiple factors, and while we realize that mental illness is a major risk factor, including things like substance abuse, we know that it's oftentimes other factors, and that, you know, people that have, whether it's clinical depression or bipolar disorder, many of them, and actually the majority of them, don't die as a result of suicide, but those that do oftentimes have other factors that are involved.
I know you looked state by state, but did you look into the demographics, and was there any difference in the increase in suicide between men and women, or older people and younger people?
Yes, we did look at the demographics, and while across the board, you know, the rates were increasing overall, it was actually increasing a little bit faster among women. And we did find that there was a difference in regards to the different states, that we found that there were about 30 states in which the rates had increased for males, but closer to 40 states in which the rates had increased for females. And as I mentioned, the rates for females were increasing a little bit faster. While overall rates of suicide are still higher among males, they were increasing at a faster rate for females. We also looked at, you know, some different age groups. And one of the things that had been noted in other studies is that what's been happening in regards to suicides, especially in the early 2000s up through the mid-2000s, is that the population where it had been increasing the fastest is working-age adults, especially those in their 30s, 40s, 50s, early 60s. We did find that, again, in our study, when you look at it state by state, is that that middle-age population, especially that working-age population, were where the rates were going up the fastest. But in looking at some of the vital statistics, the death certificate data, deaths due to suicide were going up in almost every age group. When you look at those above the age of 10, very small numbers in regards to suicide among those that are pre-adolescent, but there are still some, that the rates were going up among those all the way from 10 up to those that are 74. In every age group, it was going up. Some groups going up faster.
All this research, all this information that you were able to gather, is there anything that you learned, particularly from the states that didn't have as big a suicide increase, about what needs to change in our society to bring the suicide rates down?
One of the things that we're looking into now, and you know, our study was primarily looking at those that had died as a result of suicide. So in following that up, part of what we did at CDC was contacting some of the states, but then we've also put together what was called a technical package. And what that's at is we looked at evidence-based programs to see which were the ones that were successful in regards to suicide prevention. Now, what we didn't do and we are following up with is what states are doing with those evidence-based programs. And there are some states that are doing much more coordinated kind of activities to try to address suicide rates. But we're working with several states to try to develop a focused, coordinated, community-based approach to suicide prevention in which it looks at some of those risk groups. You know, is it looking at middle-aged adults, especially middle-aged males? Is it looking at populations like veterans or other populations that may have increased vulnerability to suicide, and being able to focus efforts on those particular populations and then be able to do something to try to lower what's happening there?
We really appreciate you sharing all this information with us today. Thanks so much, Dr. Crosby.
You're quite welcome.
That was Dr. Alex Crosby. Crosby's work includes research and assistance in the prevention of self-directed violence for the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the CDC. Next, we take a look at some of the latest research on suicide prevention with a faculty member at the Center for the Study and Prevention of Suicide at the University of Rochester Medical Center.
We help people. We don't sit in judgment over them. Scolding isn't any good.
I was thinking of killing myself. Society doesn't approve of that.
Do you?
Well, I didn't kill myself, and here I am. What do I do now?
What do you want to do?
I don't know. You shouldn't care either.
But I do care.
Why?
Because you're a stranger. There should always be someone to care for those who have no one else to care for them.
If you're wondering how our understanding of suicide has changed over the years and how that affects suicide prevention, you'll want to hear from our next guest. Dr. Kim Van Orden is associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Kim, thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
The Center for the Study and Prevention of Suicide is dedicated to reducing injuries and deaths associated with suicide, now both attempted suicide and completed. How exactly do you do that? How do you work to reduce suicide?
So at our center, we take a public health approach to suicide prevention. It's really kind of broadening the lens from just looking at suicide as a clinical problem, which would be kind of taking the approach of patients who are depressed, for example, or patients who come to an ER. That would be kind of a clinical approach to treatment. And then a public health approach broadens that. And that's really important because that allows us to think about communities and think about contexts outside of the medical center. Our approach allows us to go to settings like the court system or primary care for older people, the schools for young adults. And that's a way to reach people at risk who otherwise we may not come in contact with.
Do you know at this point in your outreach methods what works well and maybe what doesn't work so well?
You know, one of the reasons I got drawn to suicide prevention in graduate school was when I realized at that time when I started reading the literature that at that point there was a single randomized controlled trial in the world ever that had shown effects on preventing suicide deaths. And at this point, there are three in the world ever. Three randomized trials. I'm thinking, you know, randomized trials being the key tool in medicine for figuring out what helps people. So there are studies that don't use a full randomized design that have shown us some things that are useful. So given that we don't know a ton, what we do know is treating mental illness is important. So we know things like depression treatment are important. Things like collaborative care models in primary care for older people are important. Older adults have the highest rates of suicide of any demographic group in the U.S., and worldwide suicide rates rise with age. But older people are much less likely to seek out mental health care. So it's really important to address mental health in primary care for a lot of ages. And so collaborative care models allow us to do that by empowering primary care physicians with the knowledge and tools they need to treat with medications, and also then embedding care managers in primary care practices to help monitor symptoms, to check in with patients who may not be doing well, and to provide behavioral psychotherapies. We also know about the important role for social connectedness. That's a key focus of my work, is trying to figure out how we increase connectedness and what are the most important ways we can increase connectedness that will help save lives.
One thing that you mentioned earlier was your work doing outreach with the older population. Mm-hmm. And part of your work at the Hope Lab focuses on the older population. And it's really not a group of people that you would really think would be at risk. Is the older generation at particular risk of suicide?
Absolutely. One of the reasons that it's not very well known that older adults have such high rates is it just doesn't get as much attention, I think. When youth die, it gets a lot of attention and people hear about it, and rightly so. It's a tragedy. But there's a lot of, I think, ageism in our culture. And when people hear about older adults killing themselves, you often hear the response of, well, of course they wanted to die. They're old, or I'd want to die if I were them too. And so I think it's also kind of an uncomfortable topic. So, but it really is a tragedy at all ages. And most countries' suicide rates rise with age, and in particular in the U.S., the group at highest risk is white men 85 and older, and they tend to die on their first attempt, and they tend to use firearms.
Now, in terms of outreach and prevention, is it similar with the older population? What needs to happen to ensure that we can focus on older generations as well?
Yeah, again, it's such a complicated issue, but I guess a couple things that are important. One is primary care. Really at all ages, but especially in later life, most people are seen by their primary care physician in the weeks and months before they die. But the risk isn't detected. There's probably a lot of reasons for that. And in particular, older people are less likely to report suicidal thoughts to anyone. So a lot of groups think that then the response means that we should screen in primary care. I'm not one who believes that that's the approach we should take yet. We don't really know if that would be helpful. I think a key thing that I think a lot about is how behavioral interventions, things like screening, they're not inert. So they can cause harm, just how medications have side effects. So too could behavioral interventions. Now, I'm not saying it's necessarily harmful. It's a tricky thing dealing with suicidal people. It brings up a lot of emotions. So I think we need research to figure out the effect of screening in primary care on a large scale before we might take that approach. There's just a lot of barriers to making that happen. But obviously, at some point, primary care has to play an important role in that. And in whether it's screening or it's addressing things like social determinants of health, whether it's connecting people with resources like our Aging Services National Network, all have promise.
Well, Kim, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Kim Van Orden joined us from the University of Rochester School of Medicine. You can find more information about her work in suicide prevention and her work at the Hope Lab at our website.
Coming up on Take Care, we speak to a writer who thinks we need more children's books about suicide and severe depression to be sure we don't leave the younger population alone in the dark. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Take Care, brought to you by WRVO Public Media. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper. So far on the program, we've gone over the latest suicide numbers from the CDC and learned more about prevention and research that could get the country closer to solving this public health emergency. Now we turn to the younger generation.
We came across the work of our next guest after a recent article in Slate published this summer. If you want to read more, it's called Alone in the Dark: Why We Need More Children's Books About Suicide and Severe Depression. And that's what we'll be talking about now. Our producer Leah Landry spoke with Erica S. Pearl. Pearl is a writer of novels, picture books, chapter books, and more.
Thanks for being with us, Erica.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start off by asking about your latest novel, All Three Stooges. Could you tell us a bit about the book?
Sure. All Three Stooges, I should say, spoiler alert, it's not about the Three Stooges. It's a novel about two boys who are seventh graders and are best friends and are obsessed with comedy. And it's about how their friendship falls apart in the wake of an unexpected tragedy, the death of one of the boys' fathers by suicide.
And the inspiration for this book actually came from a personal experience, right?
It did. I mean, I was writing a book about boys' friendships, and I knew that there was going to be a death, and I had a friend who had died years ago from suicide, and he was the father of one of my daughter's best friends. And so when I was thinking about kind of how to put the novel together, he just kind of kept coming to mind, and I started thinking about writing about the experience of a friendship between a child who had lost a parent to suicide and a child who had no experience whatsoever with that.
And did you think it was an important story to be told?
I did, in a couple of different ways, both because suicide is unfortunately all around us. It is a leading cause of death, and it's such an incredibly painful and personal thing for the families affected, but then there's also a ripple effect in many communities. And I think it's something that's rarely talked about, especially with children. So I wanted to take that on, especially for this age group, because I think kids who are, you know, the age of my characters, which is 12 and even younger, can actually grapple with these issues and want to know more about and deserve to know about mental health and mental illness. And also I wanted to write about the experience of how suicide can touch the lives of people. Several, as I said, there's this ripple effect, so several steps beyond the immediate family. So that's sort of what I ended up writing about.
Yeah, you did quite a bit of research for the book, interviews, volunteering at a grief camp, even getting feedback, of course, from both adults and kids. What did you gather from that experience?
You know, it was interesting because, as I said, I was personally affected. I lost a friend, and I'm still friends with his widow, and so that's a family that's still part of our lives, and I also had to kind of deal with it with my children, which is something I talked about in the article, kind of how to talk to kids about something you really don't want to have to talk about with your kids. So I had dealt with it personally, but that's one person's experience. And in writing a book, I wanted to know more and kind of widen that circle. So I started doing the research. And the thing that really struck me is how individual grief can be and how, you know, while there are certain universal themes I came across, many kids and parents talked to me about survivor's guilt and about feeling, you know, uncomfortable telling people about their experience and worrying about being judged and all the kind of stigma that goes with it. But then each situation is different and each child and family grieves differently. One of the things that really struck me when I went to grief camp, many of the kids who had been affected by violent deaths like suicides might not have had the words to talk about what they were going through, but they could express it creatively in all sorts of ways. Kids found outlets through drumming and through theater and through sports and through all sorts of ways of just physically getting those very difficult emotions kind of out in the air. So it was really interesting, particularly when I was writing about boys, to kind of think about the physicality and the ways in which their grief could express itself.
You actually wrote in Slate as well that when you started to pitch the book, you had kind of a different experience than you were used to. Could you expand on that?
Sure. I mean, the interesting thing was that my editor was with me all along. When I talked to my agent and to my editor and to everyone in publishing about what I wanted to write about, I encountered no resistance. I encountered nothing but support and encouragement, which was wonderful. It was more that when the book came out and I took it out to the audience, and mostly to gatekeepers, frankly, to people who are in a position to share books with kids. Some of them kind of expressed reluctance about sharing the book widely with kids, sort of a fear, I think, in particular situations where people worried about parental pushback, the idea of showing a book to a kid about suicide when a family hadn't really broached that subject with the child themselves. And it was expressed to me that maybe it would be better if parents kind of made the judgment about whether they would pick this particular book because they might not feel their kids were ready for the topic, even though those kids may be eager and ready to learn about the world in an age-appropriate way.
Right. Do you find that there's sort of a difference or maybe a discrepancy between the availability of books about suicide and maybe death, even mental health issues, between older kids that are really in that young adult novel category and those who are a bit younger, like 10, 11, and 12?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's interesting because it's almost like there's a bright line created at 13. And that's why this was sort of an interesting challenge in writing this book, because I'm writing about kids. The kids in my book are Jewish, and they're on the cusp of their bar mitzvahs in this case. And they're being told that they're getting ready to become adults, quote unquote. And I think kids all over are told that 13 is this big step. You know, you're getting ready for high school and you're getting ready for bigger things. And in young adult novels, suicide is not a topic that is shied away from. It's a topic that is addressed in great detail by some really talented writers, and there's lots of good stuff out there. It's not a topic that is avoided. Middle grade novels, which are novels that are written for kids that are more in the kind of 8 to 12 year old space, that's much more kind of closely guarded. And that's where I found
there was more of a sense of you got to be really careful with this kind of topic. And I agree with that, but I also think that that doesn't mean you shouldn't talk about it. I don't think you should cavalierly toss a suicide into a book where it's completely out of context. But I do think that it's a topic that kids that age need to encounter and deserve to encounter, especially kids who are affected by it obviously need to see themselves in books and need to understand that their experience is normal, is shared. But also kids who haven't experienced this, you never know when it's going to come across your path. I have friends who have lost neighbors, have lost babysitters, have lost teachers in their lives to suicide. And that kind of thing you don't plan for, and all of a sudden you're trying to talk to your fourth grader about it and you don't have anything. So it seems to me that it exists in life and it should be there in books.
Yeah, I mean, obviously having a child read a book about a tough subject isn't a placeholder for having that conversation, but do you feel that these kinds of novels really serve as a jumping off point for those talks?
I do. I mean, I found that both as a parent and as an author. I think that it's great to have a book that your child reads and that you read as well, and that it can start a conversation. Especially if it's a topic that you're not sure how to kind of navigate your way into it, suddenly it's there and you can talk about it from the remove of talking about a character. So I think that's really helpful. You know, I think it's great if families are comfortable talking about these topics and, you know, with or without books. But I think that a lot of times, my understanding from my bookseller friends is that parents often show up at the bookstores and say, I don't know how to begin. And books can be a really great way to guide kids. And it's a funny age because kids really do choose their own books at this age. It's not like with a little kid where you can read the book to them. But my understanding or my experience personally is that if you leave books around, kids will sort of find them. And if you start talking about them or maybe read a little passage from them or tell them about it or kind of sell the book to them by talking about what's cool about it, kids may dip in and then you're at a point where you can have that conversation.
Thanks so much for taking the time to join us today, Erica.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
That was producer Leah Landry speaking with author Erica S. Pearl. You can find her book, All Three Stooges, at your local bookstore and online. Her article about the need for more books like hers is published in Slate.
I didn't want to say anything while her son was there, but I found this note on her desk. Most women want to take their lives because of some man. With me, it's just the opposite. I don't want to live because I have no man. Now let's get back to work. I'm 5-6-1, clear on the attempt suicide. Victim en route to the hospital.
The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is one resource available for those struggling with mental health issues or thoughts of suicide.
But it's not just the 800 number. You can text, you can find resources online, on their website for professionals, loved ones, and more. We spoke to Associate Director of the Lifeline, Sherry Sinwelski, about the service. So, Sherry, can you tell me how your services have evolved over the years? How long has the Lifeline been in operation?
The Lifeline has been in operation for over 10 years in the United States. However, the crisis hotlines that make up the Lifeline have been in operation for much longer than that. Many of our crisis centers go back 30, 40, or even 50 years.
Those crisis lifelines, do those feed into the Lifeline?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the Lifeline is actually made up of crisis centers all across the country. Over 150 crisis centers in the United States are the backbone of the Lifeline. So when a caller dials our phone number, 1-800-273-8255, the call is routed to the center that is closest to them. Or if that center is unavailable for some reason, then we have a network of national backup centers that will take the call.
And a lot of people are familiar with that phone number because recently, earlier this year, some high-profile suicides, that phone number got a lot of attention. But your service is more extensive than that. Are there other ways people can reach out for help to you?
Yeah, we have our website, suicidepreventionlifeline.org, that has a lot of valuable resources on there, including a campaign called Be the One To, which is a campaign that helps people who may be trying to be a support to someone who they care about who's at risk for suicide. We also have a chat program as well.
Oh, a chat program online?
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about the people on the other side of the line who are there to help?
It really depends from community to community because each crisis center operates independently, but they've all been through similar training. We have best practices that they must meet in terms of suicide risk assessment, as well as making decisions when a caller may be at imminent risk. So if a person is in immediate danger, we have specific guidelines that they must train their counselors on so that everybody is meeting the same standards for determining when a person may be at risk. Just for how to talk to somebody who's thinking about suicide, it can be a topic that is hard for some people to talk about if they haven't been through that particular training. And so we provide best practices for them to talk about the issue in a way that's very collaborative, that's very sensitive to the fears that a person might be experiencing if they're thinking about suicide.
And are these volunteers, or some of them, or all of them, licensed professionals?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's what I was saying when I said it depends on which center they're reaching. Each center is independently owned and operated, so some of them are primarily staffed by volunteers. In other communities, they may have primarily paid staff who are on the lines, and in some centers, they have a combination of both. They've all been trained in the same best practices.
So let's talk about some of those practices. When somebody calls the Lifeline when they're in distress or they're considering suicide or having suicidal thoughts, what happens when somebody calls? How confidential are those conversations, and what are those conversations like? I'm sure they vary.
Yeah, they do vary. But I think, you know, one of the first things that always happens is that the counselor just tries to connect with the person on a basic human level, listens to what it is that's going on. A lot of time when people are thinking about suicide, they haven't been able to talk about it with anybody. They've been perhaps fearful, or maybe they don't have anyone in their lives that is able to talk about the topic. And so the first thing that they do is just to try to connect, let them know that they're not going to judge them, that the topic is something that they're not afraid of talking about. They're going to want to learn more about the situation. Most people who think about suicide actually never act on their thoughts. And so one of the things that a person who answers the line is trying to determine is this person having thoughts of suicide, or has it escalated to something that's even more serious where they might be starting to think about acting on those thoughts, in which case they're going to try to come up with a plan to keep them safe. So, you know, what can this person do to make sure that they're going to be in a safe situation? Most of the calls that come into the line are de-escalated once the person has had a chance to talk with the counselor for a while. They're usually able to say, you know what, I'm feeling a lot better now, and are able to agree to some type of action to keep themselves safe.
Is there ever a time, though, where the counselors on your end of the line might have to alert law enforcement or first responders?
There are times when a person may be worried about the caller who's called in. If they think that that person can't stay safe, then they're going to try to find some way to do that. I was mentioning to you earlier that all of our centers must train their counselors on our imminent risk guidelines. And those are the guidelines that determine what does a counselor do if a person's in immediate danger. One of the key foundations of our imminent risk policy is the concept of collaboration. And what I mean by that is that even if a person determines that the caller may not be safe, they're going to try to work collaboratively with them to come up with a way to keep themselves safe. And there's lots of things that can be done collaboratively to avoid having to call somebody out to the person's home. Perhaps they might be willing to go see a counselor willingly, or perhaps they might be able to go to their local crisis unit if they have one in their community, or to their emergency department. We really try, first and foremost, to always use what we call the least intrusive intervention. That being said, on occasion, there are times where a call might be so dangerous that we do need to have some sort of immediate intervention. And if a person is unable or unwilling to do that, we may have to call whatever crisis services are available in their community.
As somebody who's on the front lines of trying to combat suicide, do you see it as a public health issue? And what do you think we as a society need to be doing more of to prevent this?
We definitely approach the topic of suicide as a public health issue. And I really believe that there's many layers that need to be in place in a community to prevent suicide, both in local communities and nationally. Education is really important. Making sure that everybody is familiar with what are the warning signs for suicide. And not only what are those warning signs, but what can I do if I find myself worried about somebody? Oftentimes, people who are thinking about suicide are going to go to those closest to them first, so their families or their friends. So it's important that everybody's educated on those issues and knows how to intervene and then get them to some higher level of care. It's also important that there are structures and places and communities so that when a person is in crisis, that there are services available for them. So that means, really strong crisis services, including mobile crisis, funding of crisis hotlines, and even ongoing treatment if that's what the person needs.
Well, we really appreciate you explaining how the service works and how this ongoing crisis is being addressed by you and by others. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Sherry Sinwelski is Associate Director of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. She spoke to us from Florida. The Lifeline is available any time of day, free of charge, at 1-800-273-TALK.
We have to take a short break here, but when we return, we take a deeper look at one state that has a relatively low rate of suicide, 46th out of the 50 states. Even so, they saw their rate increase, along with the rest of the nation, in the latest CDC report. We'll ask what they're doing differently and why they still face challenges. Stay with us on Take Care.
You're listening to Take Care, a health and wellness show from WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith. Today we're discussing suicide as well as mental health. Connecticut has one of the lowest suicide rates out of any state in the country. They're number 46, but they still saw an increase of more than 19% between 1999 and 2016, according to the latest data from the CDC.
Connecticut also has suicide prevention programs statewide and stringent gun control laws. We wanted to explore that connection further, so we reached out to the president and CEO of Mental Health Connecticut, Luis Perez. Mental Health Connecticut is a statewide nonprofit whose mission is to improve mental health for all Connecticut residents. Now, Mental Health Connecticut is a nonprofit organization doing work statewide to improve the mental health of Connecticut residents. And your organization's been doing that work for over 100 years. So, Luis, could you talk about the comprehensive nature of the mental health services in the state, including the ones your organizations offer?
So, the state of Connecticut is one of the states that consistently ranks among the top 10, if not the highest level of services available. In fact, last year, Mental Health America, which does a yearly ranking of all states, ranked Connecticut as number one. Of course, being number one among other states puts us in a position of sometimes feeling complacent in that we're doing well, but the reality is that the services are not sufficient and access to those services has been diminishing, particularly both in the private sector as well as the public sector.
Is this approach different than other states? Is there something about what you're doing that is a different sort of way of looking at the mental health problem, or do you think it's just more comprehensive?
I think that it is a little bit different in the sense that most states have a system of care that is county-based, as opposed to Connecticut, which operates on a statewide services and then divides those services on the public side through the regions that are determined by the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. So that's a slight difference. I think that the largest difference is in the allocation of services. We know that individuals along what we call, the midsection or the 91-95 corridor, the larger cities such as Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport, have a richer level of services available by virtue of population density, whereas we see the eastern and western side of the state having more difficulty with access to services because of the availability of providers in those areas.
Earlier in the show, we spoke to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about the rising suicide rates across the country and noticed that Connecticut is doing better than a lot of other states. And the question always is, why? Do you think that there's something about the services that you offer? When we think about mental health, we learned from the CDC there's a direct correlation to suicide. Do you think that approach is having an impact on these numbers?
I think that we certainly have been ahead of most states around prevention, and we have a lot of, again, not just the state, but also we have many very good foundations, such as the HORCO Foundation that has been doing work with youth in terms of suicide prevention. The data around suicide is very soft from my perspective because, again, people are either underreporting what may seem like maybe I took too much medication, may be an actual suicide attempt that has been underreported, for example. So for those reasons, I'm always leery about those numbers. But certainly, I think that because we have better access, everything is relative, right? Better access doesn't mean that we have 100% access, but we are ahead in terms of being able to address the mental health needs of an individual.
You mentioned at the beginning that getting the word out about mental health issues is important, and we've seen a lot of attention with some public figures dealing with mental illness and unfortunately committing suicide. Do you think that honesty and openness, that conversation helps? And what else do you think are the challenges that need to be overcome to help, you know, improve the mental health situation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I believe that we need to start at a much younger age in terms of identifying and talking to children about mental health. And when a loved one dies or when you're sad because your puppy died, that's a form of emotional distress. Not quite depression, obviously, but we don't talk and name those things at the appropriate developmental level. And I think that we need to do a better job of educating children, because as we normalize those feelings and talk about them, they're able, at an appropriate developmental level, talk about those feelings and be able to express them and be able to develop coping mechanisms so that as they get older and those stressors become larger and as they're making life transitions, such as going from middle school to high school to either college or vocational school or employment, they're better equipped to deal with disappointment and better able to deal with their emotions in a relational way as far as friendships and or with loved ones.
Well, lots of work still to be done, but we appreciate you sharing with us what has been working in Connecticut. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Luis Perez is president and CEO of Mental Health Connecticut. Perez also serves on numerous boards and committees, including that of Mental Health America.
Zero suicide is a concept that is a model for reducing suicide across the country. It essentially integrates talking with patients about their mental health and any potential suicidal thoughts they may have during visits to a primary care doctor. New York State has won a grant to use Onondaga County in upstate New York as kind of a test lab to see if the zero suicide model can be successfully integrated into an entire community health system. Alan Abbott reports.
There's a glaring number that jumps out of suicide statistics.
Nearly 50% of people who die by suicide had a primary care visit within 30 days of their death.
That's one reason the idea of integrating suicide prevention into all health and behavioral care systems could be a game changer in preventing suicide. The core concept of zero suicide contends suicide deaths are preventable, but sometimes suicidal individuals fall through the cracks of a fragmented and distracted healthcare system. So, New York State Suicide Prevention Director Dr. Jay Carruthers says the state, with the help of a $3.5 million federal grant, will create a situation in Onondaga County, New York, where all patients in all settings will be questioned about suicidal thoughts.
We want to stitch together all the different providers so that we're creating kind of a zero suicide safety net, and that's never been done. Zero suicide has only been implemented in singular health systems successfully, so this is an ambitious goal.
Onondaga County in central New York is urban, suburban, and rural, with a higher than average suicide rate for the state as well as a robust healthcare system.
And the goal is to see a 20% reduction in both suicide attempts and suicide deaths in the county.
The state has begun training behavioral health specialists in Onondaga County about assessing suicide risk, and the screening in all medical encounters will be simple, starting with two questions.
Have you thought about suicide? And have you made a suicide attempt?
Dr. Christopher Lucas, a psychiatrist and professor at Upstate Medical University, says any yes answers will lead to six more questions. And then the challenge is keeping track of who may be at risk.
It's first having a register of people that we're concerned about, and then having automatic reminders when people have failed to show up at an appointment or have cancelled an appointment. And we do that in a sort of manual way at the moment, but I think we're going to try and make it much more automated so that really it becomes foolproof.
Once it's implemented in the behavioral health arena, zero suicide will become standard operating procedure in emergency rooms, primary care offices, whether a patient's being treated for a sprained ankle or a sinus infection.
In terms of preventable deaths, this has much more immediate impact than many other things that are screened for. So I think providing it's brief, and sometimes it doesn't need to be done by the doctor themselves. It could be done by nurses, it could be done by EMTs, it could be done by community workers.
Then follow-up becomes key, especially when someone's reported an attempted suicide. That's where Dr. Sitha Ramanathan comes in. She's one of two specialists for a program called ASIP at the state-run Hutchings Psychiatric Center in Syracuse. The attempted suicide short intervention program begins with a brief therapy, then regular follow-up. It's got a great track record, first developed in Switzerland in 2013. It's reduced suicidal behavior by 80% and hospitalizations by 72%. Ramanathan likes the way it encourages patients to look at their suicide attempt.
The therapy starts with a question, tell me the story behind your suicide. So it's essentially a narrative which is videotaped, and then the patient and the therapist sit and watch the tape. And then they go through the tape and those parts and figure out so what happened and what can be changed.
Lucas says another key step is creating a plan to cope with suicidal thoughts and feelings that may come up again, a kind of suicide action plan.
What are they going to do when they start to feel stressed, when they start to feel suicidal? Who will they contact? Who will they contact if they can't find that person? What strategies will they use to make themselves feel better?
Carruthers believes this collaborative effort could be groundbreaking in the fight against a suicide rate that continues to inch up in this country.
There are pieces in place, and it's being done inconsistently. So it's all about doing this systematically and setting ambitious goals and holding ourselves to it.
I'm Ellen Abbott for Take Care.
For the latest in health and wellness this week, we find ourselves at the intersection of technology and mental health with the company MediBio. They're a self-described mental health technology company.
Well, naturally, that intrigued us, so we had producer Leah Landry find out more about what MediBio is up to. So, Leah, what's their mission at MediBio? Where did the company come from?
Their mission's actually pretty simple. They want to identify the link between physiological measures and mental health. As far as the technology they use, it's been developed over the past couple of decades. But way back 20 years ago at the University of Western Australia, two psychiatrists there were using heart monitors to look at changes in certain populations of patients. They were really interested in a range of patients who suffered from general anxiety or depression, even schizophrenia or PTSD.
So what's the company's overarching goal?
They really want to transform the way that mental health care is delivered, and they're really focused on doing that objectively. So say I go to the doctor and I have pain in my knee, and I say it's a 7 on the pain scale out of 10, and it's making a popping noise. Say you had the same pain in your knee, you go to the doctor, you say it's a 5, and that it's making a clicking noise. So these kind of diagnostic tests, if you'll call them, really mean that the patient has to be self-aware and really self-assess. MediBio isn't too interested in that. They're more interested on data, physiological data, to be able to better understand what's happening within a patient's body over time.
So how are they managing to take these measurements, and exactly what are they measuring?
They're really measuring anything from cardiac metrics to sleep metrics and our autonomic nervous system. I had to actually look that one up. The autonomic system acts unconsciously, so it regulates anything from your heart rate, digestion, respiratory rate, and more. MediBio, when they get all of that information, they do it using heart rate monitors and other wearable devices. So something similar to your Fitbit, Garmin, or even Apple Watch. But they're really trying to make sure that all of that data is actionable. They don't want data for data's sake. The aim's not just to hand over pages and pages of data about how you sleep to your physician without really any kind of way to distill that information.
Well, I can't help but think of some of our past interviews with neuroscientists and others who seem to tell us over and over again that not much is known about the brain. Is MediBio, and specifically all of the measuring that they're doing, also revealing more about the brain?
Yeah, they told me that essentially when they're measuring all of these systems in our body, they're also looking at the relationship between our brain and those systems, so our brain's attachment to every major organ. MediBio sees their technology as one of the first to provide a more definitive way to look at mental health,
and a way to make more of those discoveries, not just in neuroscience, but really in behavioral health in general.
So what's the future of this particular kind of technology? And are other companies using tech in new ways like this to approach medical care?
I mean, as we know just from producing this show, technology is really becoming a common part of health and wellness. You know, even a couple of decades ago, we didn't have heart rate monitors or GPS trackers attached to us 24/7. Wellness is popular, and technology seems to be pushing that trend along a little bit. But MediBio sees their work as more of a healthcare approach and less of a wellness approach. So they're not thinking that in 5 years you're going to wake up and say, oh, good, I slept well and my heart rate was great for the whole night. They're really interested in giving this data to your physician to help with your health care because they're so thoroughly rooted in science and data. The interesting part is they see their technology as part of the solution to the fact that there are so many people out there seeking medical care, really as a way to deal with millions of patients with very few clinicians. And looking back on our conversations with physicians and healthcare providers, that approach may not be what every healthcare provider sees as the most ideal, but it could be something that could help make one small part of providing care just a little bit easier. It's the difference between actually knowing whether your patient is sleeping well and just going off of their self-assessment alone.
Thanks, Leah.
No problem.
Our producer, Leah Landry, spent some time speaking with MediBio about their technology, mission, and more. They're a mental health technology company with offices in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Melbourne, Australia. If you missed part of our conversation today, you can find it online at WRVO.org, along with the rest of the interviews from this show.
If you'd prefer to listen to a podcast, you can also find Take Care on iTunes. Take Care is produced by WRVO Public Media. Our team includes Jason Smith, Catherine Loper, that's me, Mark Lavonier, and Leah Landry. Mark also wrote and performed our theme music. If you have questions about this show or suggestions for the future, email us at takecare@wrvo.org. Support for Take Care comes from the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith. Thanks for tuning in.